that is conducive for the service of Sri Krishna, he accepts every day with the greatest joy. So the theme, I'm not going to spend, because we've covered the reverse side in Pratikul. So Anukul means, what is asking oneself the question, what is favorable for Krishna's interest? So we have guidance from scripture, and we have guidance from our spiritual master, and we have guidance from all of these great saintly personalities who are describing the ways of Sharanagati. So we have that information, and as soon as we have that information, at once this principle of surrender is, let me accept all those things that are favorable. So there's that statement in Nectar of Instruction that one of the causes of weakening of devotional service is following rules and regulations without understanding the purpose behind them, along with not following them. What is the Sanskrit? Who knows that one? Niyamagraha. So it's broken into two words, niyama agraha and niyama agraha. So niyama, those are the regulations. So following them fastidiously, meaning very, very, very rigidly, without contemplating the purpose. Those are obstacles in achieving advancement in the path of devotional service. So here's the solution to that problem. The solution is, understand the purpose behind them. And what is the purpose behind them? To see that Krishna's interest is achieved. This is the consciousness behind the do's and don'ts, the rules and regulations of Vidhi, Sadhana, Bhakti. And if we're, this is the point, if we're conscious of the purpose behind those Vidhis, just like tomorrow's Ekadasi, we'll get some benefit if we just fast without really thinking about anything, or whatever we do to observe Ekadasi. But to awaken Bhakti, one observes the do's and the don'ts with the understanding that this will help me. It's a very Ekadasi is a very auspicious day. The scriptures indicate it is the mother of devotion. I want my devotion, my feelings of love for Krishna to awaken. So let me observe Ekadasi, not just by the fasting part, but the increasing of thought of Krishna, hearing and chanting about Krishna. Let me do that for that purpose, because it's a very auspicious day, especially to achieve that purpose. And accepting observance of Ekadasi, or any principle in that way, any principle, applying tilak, not just smearing some clay on your forehead makes you spiritual, but applying tilak, marking the body as the temple of God, and contemplating, meditating on that is pleasing to Krishna as part of his anukul, decorating. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was known to have two strands of three in some of those for his neck beads, Kunti Mala. And three of them were really big, just like our japa beads. So as he was seated on the high court bench with his very bold tilak and his big Kunti Mala, others were very clear, oh, he is a Vaishnava. And he was thinking in a very clear way, I am Krishna's devotee. I'm performing this work, being a judge, but I'm Krishna's devotee, first and foremost. There's a section that I have in my notes here about Shishupal and Kamsa. One of the things that Prabhupada liked to speak about, he spoke about it many times, was Kamsa was also Krishna conscious, but he wasn't a devotee. He was always conscious. Krishna is going to kill me. Oh, that horrible Krishna. Krishna, Krishna. Krishna's thought of Krishna was always on his mind, but it was negative. It wasn't to please Krishna. So this anukul principle is to think of Krishna by thinking always of what will be pleasing to Krishna. I'm going to skip the notes that I have to do with the details of from these songs themselves of dedication or accepting of those things for the body, meaning specifically how to engage the senses in practical activity that's pleasing to Krishna, the dedicating, like King Kulashekhar, King who achieved perfection by performing all of the nine processes perfectly. Ambarish Maharaj. So he engaged all of his senses in this anukul manner, dedicating each of the senses in that way, serving the Supreme Lord favorably. And how to practice mental cultivation. These are all in the songs, is taking things from the songs. By our actions, by our mental, what I allow my mind to think about. And if my mind goes in a direction that's not appropriate to think about, no. If the intelligence begins to try to calculate some way to achieve sense satisfaction, that's not going to help me achieve Krishna bhakti. So no, just withdraw the intelligence, withdraw the mind, withdraw the senses, and engage them positively in that which is favorable for Krishna. So that's this section. Now, I guess we'll have some time tomorrow evening, right? To cover the remaining, Bhajana Lala Sa has 13 songs. Siddhi Lala Sa has 3. Then Vigyapti, which is a prayer for spiritual request. Kabe Habe Bolo Se Din Amar. That's a request. When will that day come when I will achieve these attainments? So we'll cover that tomorrow. And then the glories of the holy name. And it gets really, really high. You have to bring your binoculars for class tomorrow. But Bhaktivinoda is teaching as Rupa and Raghunath, or Rupa and Sanatan Goswami, I guess, in the beginning, are teaching the ways of surrender up to and including the perfection. It goes from the introductory, just being a gross materialist, absorbed in nescience and so many activities of forgetting Krishna, feeling humbled by that mistake and redirecting one's attention in basic ways and gradually to stages of spiritual perfection. He's teaching us through these songs how that becomes possible. Hare Krishna. So any discussion? Particularly Anukul, Patikul related? Yeah.
Unless one takes bath in the dasa to pure devotee, one can devotee.
Yeah.
Does the dust means literally dust?
Oh, that's a favorite question. Yes. It's both. But literally. Just like, are you to bow down to the feet of a devotee or take shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna? Does it mean it literally? Yes. Does it mean it in that one should be very humble? It means both. One should be sufficiently free from the worldly consideration that I can't take such a lowly position of taking, you know, the dust, the dirty particles clinging to the feet of another person and smeared on my body, and it means one has to overcome that kind of pride. It also means literally. Someone else? Yeah. Go ahead.
How to maintain the impetus to accept the vicharabhul
position to the one thing is stay always with devotees. Impetus comes from all of our activities. If you chant your rounds nicely, read Prabhupada's books regularly, all those are sources of impetus. And it most certainly helps if we have a very sincere purpose. That what is that sincerity and purpose? I want to achieve my loving relation with Krishna. That's most important to me. As my day-to-day life unfolds, I want to feel drawing closer to Krishna, and when the end of my life comes, I want to feel very connected and close to Krishna. I want to be in that relationship with Krishna. I have to cultivate that now. So that will give us impetus.
Maharaj, regarding rejecting the unfavorable literature for devotion service.
Unfavorable literature?
For devotion service.
Okay.
Before coming to devotion service, I learned about some books like The Chariots of God, Windmills of God, which are speculations on God. They arouse some interest to understand about God in me. So are there any authentic literatures which explain these mysteries like the Great Pyramids and all those things?
Not that I know of. He wants to know, are there authentic literatures that describe far-out things? Like pyramids, and there's only one source that I know of. There may be other sources, but Sariputta's books. Just because I know him personally, and he's a person of such incredible spiritual integrity, but he has a concern that persons have an interest in, you know, parapsychology and epiphenomena and, you know, flying saucers and all kinds of, you know, extraterrestrial things. So he has a personal fascination for them, but he is interested in, are there legitimate transcendental explanations for unusual phenomena? And he's very careful, but he does explore that stuff. I was once in Lima, Peru, and I was at the home of a husband and wife couple that were completing their fourth PhD. And that probably by now they're working on their fifth or sixth. And it was all in languages. And they were very fascinated with studying through the medium of language how so many cultures are connected to the Vedic culture. And they were interested in showing not only that there's a connection between this culture, that culture, this literature and that theme, but that factually the source of it all was the Vedic culture. At that time they were studying the Incan culture, and I don't know what the language is, I guess Incan language or something. But Greek, you know, the Greek texts, Sanskrit texts, some Arabic texts, and I mean, I, it was certainly far out and fascinating, and how scientific it was, I can't vouch for that. At least I can say that, you know, their interest. They had an agenda. As scholars, they wanted a priori to establish the authenticity of Vedic culture. But they were really excited about the whole thing, page after page after page of showing this text in Arabic and this text in Greek and this text in Incan and how it compares to the Vedic text. And that entomologically the Vedic text is most ancient, but all these cultures derive, they have their roots in. And other people say, no, it's from Africa, but it's not Africa, and here's why. And they're really into it. There's some of our devotees that are doing studies on the Aryan invasion theory. That's not, you know, it's not pyramids, but it's studies of ancient culture and how it connects. Some of them are looking at when you find archaeology, there we go, archaeological evidence about the Aryan invasion theory that disproves it. Linguistic arguments that disprove it. And then there's a third one. Scriptural textual references that were the underpinnings of the Aryan invasion. It's actually like three references from the Rig Veda that did the whole thing, the Aryan invasion theory. And they pulled the rug out from under the whole thing. You know, the assumptions that established it amongst the intellectuals of the late 1800s that has been accepted for so long, because it was based on, you know, they went back and looked at the texts that in the Rig Veda, what did it say, and compared that to the Brahmanas from other portions of the Vedas and how they compare. And anyway, they were debunking the Aryan invasion theory just by a scholarly approach. And if you like stuff like that, that's out there.
But in principle, I understand that Srimad Bhagavatam is enough for perfection of life. So does reading these kind of books help improve my convictions, or just I can leave it out?
It's not even secondary, it's tertiary. It's kind of like a it's helpful for our preaching, it's not helpful for attaining Krishna consciousness. It's helpful to shake the foundation of misconceptions, to allow persons who have those misconceptions to read Srimad Bhagavatam more open-mindedly. It's not going to help you read Srimad Bhagavatam and attain love of God by reading it in the proper mood, unless you're one that has those fundamental speculative conceptions, because part of attaining the stage of pure devotion is jnana karma anavritam. So it's helped in the jnana anavritam process, eradication of speculative knowledge. Now, really, you get a chance to ask your question. Do you have a question? Do it. We don't want. I think I've got it, but I'm not sure. Do it again. Slow. Krishna's Sarva Karna Karnam, that I got. Conditioned living entities, they also. We discussed that purport about Shukracharya. He was saying, money is the honey. And if something interferes with getting the money, getting the honey, get rid of it. This vamana day, get rid of them. But we do particle anukul in material realm also. And is Krishna, that's a reflection of the spiritual condition. It's a perverted reflection of the spiritual condition. So we have to change the criterion. What do we accept? On what basis? What's the standard by which we accept and reject things? This is a function of the mind. Sankalpa, vikalpa, right? You know that from Nectar of Devotion? The mind has these two functions, accepting and rejection. Right? You're with me? Prabhupada describes that the fruitive worker, he works very hard for 5 days of the week, and then he needs a vacation. Sankalpa, vikalpa. But after some time, he's ready to go back to work because money is the honey. If he could work 7 days of the week, he would do that. But it doesn't suit him, so he needs a couple of days. And that's the way of speculation is, and we experience this all the time, that in the mind a proposal of how we can achieve a certain objective that will make us happy, and even as the mind is formulating the proposal, the mind is also saying, no, that won't work because, and it breaks down, and then we have to put another one up there. Accepting and rejecting. We do it all the time. But it's standardless, and it's tasteless. There's not any real happiness. That happiness for the materialist is sense gratification, but it's never fulfilling. And so they have to adjust their position of what they accept and what they reject. So they're going for a ride on the chariot of the mind. Manoratena. Right? So there is a natural position of accepting and rejecting, and that's this accepting of what's favorable for Krishna. Just regaining our healthy instead of our diseased condition. Does that address your question? Not exactly. Krishna is Sarva Karana Karanam. Huh?
Connected to the Krishna is Sarva Karana Karanam. We are seeing that is one of the cause of something.
Krishna is the cause of everything, including this one. And then there's my what I was explaining is there's a material reflection which Krishna is the cause of also. Krishna is the cause of shadows. Just as light, there's no shadows without light. Right? There's no darkness without light. Krishna creates the object that interferes with the light that makes the shadow. Otherwise, there's no meaning to shadow. He's the cause of all causes. Written this question? Okay. You'd like to know, he's referring that sometime during this visit I narrated the story of Maharaj Ambarish and his father Nabhaga, and how Nabhaga had two qualities that were very, very pleasing to Lord Shiva, and therefore he granted him a special favor. One of those qualities was simplicity, so he'd like an explanation of what is a good manifestation or exhibition of simplicity, and what is a bad manifestation of simplicity. Have I got it right? And it's in such a way that you can accept the very positive way of simplicity to help you in your Krishna conscious practices. Well, I think the most direct way to express this is that the beneficial way of or how the principle of simplicity can serve us well in our process of Krishna consciousness or approaching surrendering to Krishna is to take Krishna's statements directly without interpreting them, like Prabhupada has done with Bhagavad Gita as it is. The contrasting position is to take indirect meanings. In Sanskrit, this is not to be done. One of the things to be done is to take direct meanings from the Sanskrit words. The condition is, unless the direct meaning is very clearly inappropriate, then we take it as that it's implying something that we are to then understand in an indirect way. But the preferred and general rule is you take the direct meanings, and that's simple. Krishna says, surrender unto me, and that means surrender to Krishna. That's favorable. unfavorable is to say, Krishna doesn't really mean that. He means something else. The something else that he means is, you fill in the blank. Surrender to something else. One commentator says, it means, Krishna really doesn't mean surrender to him. It means to surrender to the unborn. Prabhupada's very simple rendering is, if Krishna wanted to say, don't surrender it to me, but surrender to the unborn, he would have said it. He didn't say it. He said, in fact, he doesn't even speak of anything unborn. He just says, surrender it to me. So, very simple. Surrender to Krishna. That is a beneficial way of being not overly complicated, not unnecessarily complicated. Go like this. But someone says, I don't want to do like that, I want to do like this. You try to touch your nose. You can try like that, but it's very simple and very direct. So rather than a convoluted, complex, indirect, interpreted rendering of some instruction, it's very simple. Now, an unbeneficial way of simple might be if I hear an instruction, if I don't understand it clearly, I should ask for clarification. So it's not beneficial if one is so simple that I don't ask for clarification. One practical example that comes to mind is I was in Delhi and I asked Krishangi Mataji if she could get me a lota, but you know, a little bit. A little bit bigger than, you know, one of these for drinking. So she asked one of the students, can you go to the marketplace and get Maharaj a little drinking vessel, lota? And he brought back this, you know, flower vase. And she brought it to me with she was in between laughing and crying. She said, you know, I don't, just look at this. I don't know whether to laugh about it or cry about it. And the person may think, well, she asked to bring back the lota. So we may need to inquire just to get things very clear. And that's part of simplicity, being very clear, and then executing. Does that help? Yes.
I also understand the statement that even not to see the face of non-mental.
Even?
Not to see the face of
non-mental. How are we to understand these statements, because there's a few of them. One should not even see the face of a non-Vaishnava. In practical terms, it's not how we lead our lives. Because here we are, but we're at least for one who is, it's something like the Smarta statement, meaning, but the application of it is obviously not that from an elevated Vaishnava. So in ordinary, the contaminations of this world are very strong, and one who is diligent in spiritual, on a spiritual path, knows that material association and material distractions are very detrimental to one's spiritual path. For that reason, such persons will often completely go to a secluded place in a forest or whatever, so that they're not even encountering those things. There's not even a chance to encounter those things. The problem is, where do you find such a secluded place? And our minds are so active and agitated and disturbed that even in a secluded place, our mind will dwell on those things. Like Prabhupada's example of Sobri Muni and different persons who are just encountering things of nature, their minds became disturbed. You know Sobri Muni's story? He's underwater meditating just so he won't experience MTV and radio and firecrackers and other things that distract one's mind. So while he's underwater, he sees two fish having union, reproducing, and his mind becomes agitated. Wherever you go, there's something that will inflict the mind with something that will agitate it, even if one does one's best to reduce it. So this is one of those things that will agitate the mind, is being in the association and even seeing persons who are averse. So he's, Bhaktivinoda is alluding to that understanding. We don't live our, your question was, how do we apply ourselves to those statements? Well, we specifically, as aspiring transcendentalists, are trying to receive the mercy of Lord Chaitanya as our protection. And as followers of Lord Chaitanya, this was something that I was going to read this morning on the subject of the devotee of Lord Chaitanya is duty-bound to preach or to give spiritual association to others, and that's accomplished here in cities. There's lots of people. So our protection in this particular regard is the protection extended by Lord Chaitanya to his devotees who take up the mood of Sankirtan, of extending compassion to others. Because if we don't have that protection, then even these ordinary things that we experience every day, they have some adverse effect. The smells and the sights and the sounds and the impressions on the mind of material society will pull our consciousness down. It agitates the mind, covers our spiritual consciousness day in and day out. There's a constant barrage of the stuff. So we need protection. And that protection is facilitated. Lord Chaitanya arranges for protection for those who are in the mood of his Sankirtan performers, accepting a position of serving Lord Chaitanya in that way. But at least, as far as practical application, we shouldn't make such persons our close associates. Meaning, disclosing didati pratigranati, disclosing confidential subjects, because they won't understand them and they won't give us good advice. And it's not where our intimate friendships should be. That much we should observe carefully. Yes.
Maharaj, while speaking on the subject, purity is the force.
Yeah.
You had read out a letter from Srila Prabhupada, the devotee, which said that uninitiated devotees should not be permitted to handle the devotees.
Yeah.
So, is it okay if they have devotees at home?
Yeah, what Prabhupada was writing about was temple standards, and home worship has a different standard. That's a simple answer. Because temple deities are installed, and home deities often are not installed, and there are different standards when they're installed. Installed immediately means very serious. Without fail, every day at a certain time. Very fixed standards. And it's not just, you know, what some particular acharya says or not. It's in scripture. It's in their Vaishnava tantras, Hari Bhakti Vilas and Narada Pancharatra and scriptures that indicate what standards are to be met. Or installed worship, installed deities. And to neglect that is offense. And this is one of those standards. However, with worship at home, in most cases, some cases, the devotees install have their deities installed and maintain. In turn, they maintain a very strict standard. It's the same as in the temple. But then they're initiated. But then even initiated, they still have to maintain the standards, the other standards, artis and offerings, and serve their deity. And it's a very, very, deity worship is a very serious thing. So if there's home worship, I think what you're getting at, I'm explaining there are other parts other than what you're directly asking. If someone that is not initiated, is it okay or is it recommended that they have deities? And particularly, Prabhupada's instruction is there, as there are different standards with different deities, so in the case of Gaura-Nitai deities, it's best to have just pictures until one is fixed in one's practices. And then worshipping of Gaura-Nitai, they're very, very merciful. Particularly in this regard, they accept our worship and not our mistakes. They're very merciful. And so Gaura-Nitai worship is particularly recommended in the beginning stage of deity worship. So as you saw in Chicago, the number of the devotees have deities in their home. But they know, some of them are initiated, but then they know they must be very strict with regard to following of the principles, four regular principles, and their chanting, their sadhana practices. They have to come before the deity in a very clean, internally and externally condition. And it's uplifting them and helping prepare them for that further stage. That should be their understanding. Very mercifully, Lord Chaitanya is manifesting himself in this form to accept my worship, so I can become elevated and purified. Lord Jagannath deity is also like, not in the same degree, but like Lord Chaitanya, very merciful deities. Merciful in the sense that the standard of their worship, even installed, is not as rigorous as Radha Krishna worship. How does one get the
mercy of a Vaishnava?
Mercy of a Vaishnava. Well, by nature, so his question is, how does one get the mercy of a Vaishnava? And, well, Vaishnavas are naturally very merciful. So it's not so difficult. The main thing that one needs to do is you try to please them. There's a very nice, not more, very wonderful description of one Vaishnava who had that as his mission, that namely getting the mercy of all the Vaishnavas in Bengal. And his name was Kalidas. You know this story? You know the story. You want to hear the story? Once upon a time, Kalidas was a very humble, not particularly prominent devotee. Very humble devotee, and he made this vow that he wanted to offer words of praise and receive the prasad remnants of every Vaishnava in all of Bengal. And at that time, during the time of Lord Chaitanya, there must have been a lot of Vaishnavas in Bengal, because Lord Chaitanya appeared in West Bengal. And then Bengal wasn't divided east and west. It was one big place, including Bangladesh, one big place. So Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says that the story I'm going to narrate gives you an idea of how Kalidas did this same thing with each and every Vaishnav in all of Bengal. Kalidas was a Brahmana, and he went to the home of anybody and everybody, and he brought with him some mango and a banana leaf, and made an offering to that family. Please accept this as a gift. And I would like you to take it, and I'd like to take the remnants of the mango after you've eaten, knowing that they would say no, and because, you know, you're a Brahmana and you're elevated and I'm not elevated, they would speak words of humility, and then Kalidas would glorify one who chants the holy name. By glorifying the holy name, and one who takes the chanting of the holy name is a Vaishnava. And they're very dear to you. Such a Vaishnava as you is very dear to Krishna. So there's nothing wrong with my accepting remnants of the prasad that you've taken. And he gave many, many, many quotes, and they would be very appreciative of his nice quotes. He was such a humble but very learned Vaishnava, Brahman. And so they said, very well, you know, we'll accept and we'll just offer this to our deity. So Kalidas then left the house and hid behind a tree. And he would wait till the housewife cut the mango and offered it to their deity, and the husband would first take the mango and the wife would take the remnants and suck on the seed, and then she wrapped up the mango skin and mango seed and the banana leaf and threw it in the garbage. And go back in the house. And Kalidas would wait till she disappeared, then go take the banana leaf and lick the banana leaf, take the remnants, suck on the pit of the mango and feel ecstasy that he's taken the remnants of the prasad of these nice Vaishnavas. And one by one he did like that. But we can't imitate Kalidas. We can learn some lesson. That if we regard not just a particular exalted, highly qualified Vaishnava, then we can get the mercy of Krishna through that person. But Kalidas had the conviction that all such persons who call upon the name of Krishna, they're worshipable by me. And I want to receive their mercy. So there's a particular pastime once when the devotees were visiting Jagannath Puri for Rath Yatra. Lord Chaitanya was entering the temple of Lord Jagannath, and the practice was there's a particular, like a little gutter, where before entering the temple, water is poured on the feet and the water runs off the gutter and out of the way and with clean feet, because the feet were bare and they're washed. You go into the temple with clean feet. So Lord Chaitanya forbid that anyone would touch the water that washed his feet. But Kalidas approached and boldly held his hands out, cupped, as Govinda, his servant of Lord Chaitanya, washed his feet. And Kalidas took one handful and a second handful and a third handful and held his hands out for some more. And Lord Chaitanya scolded him and said, "Kalidas, I've given you enough. Please go away." Because Lord Chaitanya was very strict. He would forbid this from anyone. But he allowed Kalidas. He gave Kalidas special mercy because of the matured faith that Kalidas had developed. He pleased Lord Chaitanya so much. He gave him that mercy. By the mercy of the Vaishnavas, one can achieve such mercy only. So what we should do is try to appreciate, as I was explaining several times, I'll say it again, we should appreciate the service of the other devotees. We should, within our mind, appreciate, within our words, express our gratitude and appreciation, not only for the service, but the mood of service with which the devotees render their activities. And do something to try to, with our body, so with our words, with our mind, and with our practical activities, do something to exhibit our gratitude for those devotees. And naturally it's very pleasing. What services do you do here? You know, you serve out prasadam, or you help cut the vegetable, or you clean the... What services do you do?
I'm staying there.
The stairs and the upstairs balcony?
He says he's staying in the university.
At the university. So in your group at the university, you do something to assist the other devotees? What is it that you do? What service do you do there amongst the group of other students? Cooking?
They have a rotation system. Every devotee does all the services in rotation.
Cooking service?
All services.
All services.
They do it in rotation.
So, supposing one of the other devotees, or whoever is the authority in charge of that supervising that rotation in the services, expresses to you, my dear Prabhu, I just want you to know, we sometimes take each other for granted, but I really appreciate how conscientious you are in taking care of the services, whatever it is that you do. I just want to share that with you. I'm very, very grateful. You know, devotee doesn't need that, but a little encouragement helps. All of us who feel, oh, that's nice. You feel encouraged to, even if you're not doing it so conscientiously, let me really try to do it conscientiously with the mood of serving the other devotees. Just that. So, as someone might please you as a devotee who is trying to make a little advancement in Krishna consciousness, you do like that to others. Go out of your way. Don't just take for granted the fact that Love Yovana, for example, is thinking about the welfare of everybody that's here and those that aren't here every day. And that's a lot to think about. Or the care that Shamrani gives, and of course she likes doing it, but in dressing the deities very nicely every morning for the pleasure of the deities and for the pleasure of the devotees. So express your gratitude to her or any of the other devotees, the services that they do. And is there something that I can do one day of the week? Can I make the garlands, or can I clean the arti? Some service that I can do to assist you. How would she think? How would you think? It's not a difficult thing. Pleasing a devotee, gaining the favor of a devotee. It requires being not lazy. And requires being personal and feeling some genuine affection and appreciation for another and expressing it with your words, feeling it within your heart, and performing something meaningful in your practical activity to demonstrate that you're not just saying something but you really mean it. And gain the favor of that devotee. Very easy. And it's very joyful. We don't do those things enough. We're too busy to be nice and affectionate and appreciative and demonstrative. We're too busy. And then we take each other for granted, and we become contemptuous. We start finding the faults. It happens. Familiarity breeds contempt. So don't allow that. Don't become familiar in the bad sense, but become very appreciative of the other devotees. And that will help them also, not just feel good, but feel, gee, I really want to do this service of dressing the deities because it's inspiring the devotees. And Lord Jagannath will be very pleased if all the devotees waiting for the curtain to open see Lord Jagannath very nicely decorated. Nice. Increases the Krishna consciousness of everyone and each and every single service that happens. Let's just see if there's someone that hasn't. Yes.
How good is it? Vrindavan things comes under the
Vrindavan. You want to know the question?
Yeah.
how to reject unfavorable things which come into the mind. There's lots of things that come into the mind to answer that question. One instruction Bhaktisiddhanta gives is to neglect such thoughts or undesirable things that come into the mind. Or conversely, it's when we invest consciousness or invest importance in those things, they take on a life of their own. Actually, so a thought that's unwanted, like any other thing, it's just dull matter. And it becomes animated it becomes as real as life if we take it very seriously and contemplate it and get all absorbed in it. It takes on a greater significance than it really is. Actually, Bhaktisiddhanta gave two remedies. Neglect and to beat with a stick. Just like a lion, Bhaktisiddhanta gave this example. How do you train a lion? First business is to starve him. And then when he's really, 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 really just weak, then you, with your hand, you give him a little something, but not very much. So after some time, he sees the hand as his sustenance. So similarly,